You're listening to the 405 Exchange Podcast. My name is Ken Grandpierre, and today's episode is with Matt Mays. What can be said about him that hasn't been said before? Matt Mays is a legendary fixture of the Canadian music world, a man who's truly seen it all. He's toured relentlessly for over a decade and has amassed fans who deeply care about the heart that he pours into his songs. His latest offering, Once Upon a Hell of a Time, is a true rock record through and through. It's one of those albums that a musician spends their entire life trying to make. Within this talk, I go deep into the recording process with Matt and the experiences that inspired the songs off the album. We also go into what it's been like to experience life on the road the special way that he has. This is the 405 Exchange with Matt Mays. Enjoy. So the feeling I had after listening to your album, Once Upon a Hell of a Time, is that I can't remember the last time I listened to a record that sounded that good. Like, particularly, yeah, like,
thanks, man.
Just a true rock record in so many ways.
Yeah, you know, it's, I appreciate that, but, it's rock and roll sort of what I do, you know, and we just, I kind of like that it's not really, like, that popular anymore. I kind of like, I feel like I'm doing something kind of cool and boutique now. It's weird being a rock and roll band and saying that, but we kind of wanted to make it sort of, you know, a lot of classic sensibilities, but still sound modern, you know, make it so relevant, and I'm pretty proud of Lowell, who plays drums with me and a band called Winter Sleep. He produced it with me, and we found the sound, and just we kind of ran with it.
Yeah, there's so much I want to ask you in general, but particularly about this record, and I guess the first thing I really want to jump into is, do you remember what the first day in the studio was like? Because I imagine making a record like this was like a pretty holistic experience.
Yeah, it's Lowell and I have been really good friends for a long time since we were kids, playing in bands in Halifax, and for over 20 years now I've known him. And we were just at a bar one night, and he was like, I got this cool like beat on the drums, and he's like, I was like, well, can I go hear it? And he's like, yeah, he has a studio in Montreal, and it used to be Arcade Fire's studio back in the day. Yeah, they did a good chunk of Funeral there. It was Wynn and Regine's apartment, actually. It's where the studio is, where we recorded this record. So it's more of a hangout kind of space. It's a studio. Anyways, we went back there, and he showed me the beat, and it's like, I got this riff, man. And so I just kind of put the riff on. Yeah. And then by the end of the night, we had a song. Mind you, it was 6 in the morning, but we had a song. And then I just remember how good it felt, how like pure and real. And it's like, this is how you do it, you know? Because I've been in a lot of fancy studios where you're sort of, you know the clock's ticking and blah, blah, blah. But with this situation, it was a lot different, where it was just two best buds just making music, you know? And that's all we did. I liked it so much, I moved to Montreal in with Lowell, and we decided to make a record out of it. So we were writing songs as we were going, and I had all these half songs and lines in my head, and we just kind of went through it all. So
how long was that period of time?
It was a good solid like 3 to 6 months, I guess. But then I would go back, we'd do a few more touch-ups and things. But it was still all in all, but 6 months we kind of got it. Yeah. I lived there for 6 months, and you know, we worked from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. because the band Stars, they rehearse all day there too.
I love Stars.
Yeah, so yeah. Stars let me use all their stuff too.
Oh, that's working.
So all those guitars and everything, they all belong to the Stars, yeah.
No wonder why it sounds so clean.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So that was it, but I moved there, but we had to go all night, so we'd start at 7 p.m. and go till 7 a.m. and sleep all day and go back in. And but it was cool because the city was either really happening, really quiet. It was kind of a vibey time to record, you know.
Yeah, it's funny because you always hear people talk about how they want to get away from cities when recording albums because of distractions. But I imagine for a musician, especially like you, it's almost like having that city is helpful because it's like you're constantly interacting with people and living.
Totally. That's what's great about New York City. I lived here for a long time, and I did so much songwriting and I was so creative here because of the distractions. And I think it's the way my mind is. I really love, you know, my attention has weird issues, and I'm kind of like, you know, so I think the best thing for me as a songwriter is distraction, because half the time the distraction is something cool that somebody said on the street that you turn into a line on the record, or, yeah, you know what I mean, that kind of thing. If you're at the country, which I've tried before, it's like super quiet, there's somebody there, and then you're just alone with your songs and your album. Yeah. It kind of gets scary, right? So
yeah, in a lot of ways, it's like you can only be with your own thoughts for so long, really.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's it. And that's exactly what happened in the country. So I love recording in the city, and it's the best, yeah.
You know, something that blew me with the album is that it's immediate and fast, yet there's a strong importance towards melody that's in there. And I wonder, how important is it for you to make sure that melody is a prominent aspect of your songs? Because it feels very deliberate.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if a song doesn't have a melody, I don't really believe it's a song, you know, unless the lyrics are... You know, we listen to I can't believe I forgot the name of the tune right now. Bob Dylan's song, Johnny's in the Basement Mixing Up the Medicine, and I'm gonna, you know, like, yeah. That has one note as a melody, but it's an incredible melody because it's sort of like a rap, even, you know. So it's then that's a different story. Like, if there's nothing that's catchy, then like it's not gonna be a song. So that's why like hip hop is great, rap music is great, because it's so catchy and the words are, you know, there's flow and there's a certain thing. But if you don't have that, or you don't have a melody, it's like, you got what, and what do you have? What can people actually latch onto? You know, nothing really, you know? But, so that's why I kind of made sure that every song on Once Upon a Hell of a Time, I can play on the ukulele and it'll hold up at a campfire, you know? Even though there's like a million things on it and it's really produced.
That's a really good test to have.
Yeah, and I just finished recording Twice Upon a Hell of a Time, I'm calling it, where it's, I actually did that. I did all, no, I'm doing the whole record in the same order, just on piano and acoustic guitar and ukulele.
Wow.
With all the same songs, just because the songs hold up on their own, you know?
I'm definitely gonna ask you more about that. Before I sure. do, I wanna ask about some of the songs off the album. First off, my favorite, which is probably a lot of people's favorite, but Sentimental Sins. Like, that's a track I've gravitated towards a lot, and I imagine I'm far from the first person to tell you that.
Right.
How close is that song to being what you originally envisioned it being?
Really close, actually. Yeah, really close. And it was weird, because most times I've had things sort of demoed out a lot, and I had a few, like, a little demo of it on, like, a ukulele, I think. But yeah, that one came really easy. It was one of the first ones we did, and it came very easy. It was very, it kind of wrote itself, it kind of recorded itself, the parts kind of just came, it was very easy sort of to enter into the whole mix. Yeah.
I know it's going to sound like a weird question, but was it like, because like when you listen to that track, you could almost feel and hear the sweat, like was it like a hot room? Like it feels very tight, like the way you guys are playing.
Yeah, you called it. We were in there once, it was so hot, there's no air conditioning up there, that Lowell and I we'd just take breaks and just lay on the floor to let our bodies cool,
yeah.
You know, because that was the only way we could figure out how to like cool down. It's just like...
The glamorous life of a musician.
Yeah, and then we recorded into the winter when we're doing sort of, you know, added a few more songs. I remember we left the window open one night and there's a full snowdrift in the studio in the morning, and we were freezing our asses off. You know, hear some of that on the album too, but there, I think that one particularly was actually a hot session. Yeah, yeah.
Jesus. And to me, like, this is one of the songs that echoes how much for you, Matt, like as a musician, must have fallen back in love with being in a band. I feel like across the album there's like a big strong aspect of that, like falling back in love with guitar and being a musician. And I wonder, like, for you, when you listen back to the album for the first time, did that vibe come across to you? Like, were you kind of, do you remember how you felt when you listened to the album back?
Yeah, I think Lowell and I, there's something that happens when we play together that's just so exciting, you know? And I think that's why we did the record. We just started recording because he felt it too. And we did most of these, like, with I would plug in a guitar and he would play drums and have a mic, and we worked out the songs really loud and really just having fun jamming, like two lights, right? And that's how we kept the record. So most of them had a bed track of me and him playing together and singing together. Yeah. And kept it really live. And just because we were so, you know, in love with playing like live, loud rock and roll music. And I'm glad you hear that, because that's kind of what we were trying to capture, you know.
That's really special. Truest Life is one of those obvious songs that's meant to be like an album opener. And it also feels like very cathartic. Like, was it a cathartic song to make? And was it obvious to you to have it be like the album opener?
It was, yes and no. We bounced around a lot of different sequences of songs, but that one felt good to kind of intro the record, as far as like, this is the song, this album is about life, and it's about love, and it's about, you know, sort of place, a sense of place, and so it kind of encapsulated all those things that the record kind of does. So I thought it'd be a good intro. And yeah, you know, I went through a really tough breakup, and And it felt very cathartic to actually get a lot of these songs out on the record and to sort of express anger and express, you know, still love and all that, those things. And I think that song kind of does all that. So that's why it sort of made the cut for the first song.
Yeah. You know, something that really got to me with that song, and it gets me every time I listen to it, but the line, "I gotta get it wrong before I get it right." Like, that's one of those lines, man.
yeah, awesome. Yeah, well, that's, you know, the only way you write a line like that is to actually learn that, you know,
yeah.
And I've got a lot of stuff wrong, you know, but then, you know, you get older, and because of that, you start getting a lot of stuff right, you know, and I think that's just being a human being.
That's like the whole arc of living a life.
And that's why I think, like, younger people, even in their 20s, shouldn't get too hard on themselves, because that's what the 20s are for, is to get it wrong, so that when you're, you know, in your 30s and 40s, you know, you start getting it right, you realize why. But I tell my younger friends that, like, don't get too hard on yourself. This is how you learn, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's fine. I'm 27, and I feel like amongst my friends, all we ever talk about, prominently, we talk about looking back to maybe just, like, 24, 25, and just going, like, Jesus. And then almost feeling afraid that the aspect of progression and change that we wish would have happened hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, totally. Trust me, I'm 38. And you don't change. Like, I remember being 27 and going, like, oh man, I'm getting old, man. This is crazy. I'm like, damn, this feels old.
Yeah.
But man, like, I feel much less old at 38 than I did 28. You know, it's sort of like you realize that you don't really get older. Your body gets older, and that's it.
Blows my mind.
You know, so it's sort of like it's about the choices you make to do what you should be doing and doing what makes you happy and being a good friend or a good lover or whatever. That's important. But everything else really doesn't matter, you know. It's just about contentment and working towards what's going to make you the most content. Not happy, or happy in the sense of, like, money and this and that. It's just like contentment is kind of the true happiness. Like, being really content and happy and proud of yourself, that's what you have to work for. But it doesn't really change with age. It's just the decisions that you make. But and that's going back to, you got to get it wrong before you get it right, you know. It's just, you can apply all the things you learn in your 20s, but... Yeah, I mean, you guys, you know, you shouldn't really start feeling old until I think you're 90, you know.
Well, hopefully you live by that too, then.
Yeah,
you can't have any, like, midlife crisis at 40, then.
No, exactly. It's a thing. And I think because I've lived a pretty crazy, you know, very unique life, I don't think... I've kind of done all of the things the crazy things I wanted to do. I have friends that are, you know, they're turning 40 and they're, like, you know, buying sports cars and they're doing, you know, but I already... I'm kind of the opposite. I kind of want to kind of cool it down a little bit in that department and actually just, you know, like, realize that sports cars not going to make me happy, you know. I love sports cars and it'll make me happy for a very short time driving it. But you know what I mean? It's not like, you know, showing one off or whatever. That's fucking bullshit. But.
No, exactly. And, you know, I brought up before how your record was like a rock record, but I think it's very important to point out that there's also a lot of experimentation going on. And I feel like Hell at the Night is a prime example of that. Because you're playing with keys and harmonies on that track that's very, I feel like, different in contrast to your previous music.
Right.
Does a track like that feel different to you? And what was the journey of that specific song?
It's weird. It all started with a line. Lil and I were jamming out, and I started with a line. It was actually a New York line. The church bells wake me up in whatever town I wake up in, you know. If you're trying to look alive out there for you, like, it, just trying to be good for the crowd.
Yeah.
And that was the start of the song, and I actually cut that verse out. It doesn't sound like that anymore, but that line wrote the rest of the song, and it kind of, and it's just, you know, we heard it the way it should kind of sound a little bit when I started singing this melody. My friend's dog actually came up with, this sounds crazy, I
what?
Know, but the, ooh, my friend had a dog that would start howling every time he would hear an ambulance. Like, I couldn't even hear it, but I could maybe barely hear it, or if he started howling, I knew there was an ambulance siren somewhere that he could hear and I couldn't.
Yeah.
But one night he started howling, and I was playing guitar, and he was like, ooh, and I lost my falsetto, but he was like, ooh. And I was
what,
like, that's kind of cool. So I was like, it was kind of close to the same key. But yeah, it was crazy. So yeah, I got to give songwriting notes to credit to Charlie. But so I had that melody, and then from there we kind of wanted it to be kind of spacey, and we tried it a few different ways and tried to rock it out a bit, but it didn't really work. And wanted it to be a little more intimate sounding, and like a bit of a love letter, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure this is going to be brought up in the intro, but we're in New York right now, and because we're in New York, I of course have to ask about New York City Girls. I mean, that's a damn great tune, and I feel like for any... I mean, I don't want to, like, condense it too much, but I feel like for any guy who has lived, worked, and, like, been in the city, you could definitely relate to that song. Yeah. Who do you think it is you're speaking to in this song? Because yours, it feels like you're speaking to somebody.
Oh, yeah, I'm definitely speaking to somebody. That song I wrote, it's cool. It's kind of about a bar, too. Like, my favorite bar in New York is the 11th Street Bar.
Oh, that's a great one.
Yeah, and my friend Kenny bartends there, and he's a legend, you know? He's been working there a while, and Kenny was sort of like, you know, sort of like my therapist. You know, I used to go in and the place would be empty, and he's, you know, Kenny's been around, and he knows what's going on, so. And, he kind of helped me out with my girl problems and stuff. And this song is actually very true, you know? And actually, I took the boys to meet Kenny, because I was there playing the song. I was like, you guys got to meet Kenny, you know? I mean, I was with a girl here for a very long time, and it's kind of supposed to be a little funny too, you know, like stuff off, you know, like it's very, you know.
What I love so much about it, I've been living here since 08. I originally came here for college and then ended up staying and working and just been here ever since, and I've had a couple relationships and the whole type of thing, and like, it feels almost kind of weird to say it, but like, when I heard the song, what triggered in my head, it was like, I wouldn't know how to describe a New York City girl to somebody, or like what that dynamic of a relationship could be like.
Yeah.
But hearing that song, it was like, wow, you put like pen to paper and somehow, like you somehow put it out there.
Yeah, yeah. It was, you know, it's tough because I mean, I kind of hate to generalize, you know?
Like, no, me too. I'm kind of hesitant to generalize it too, yeah, but that's like a thing.
I feel kind of guilty about the song a little bit because I never generalize, and especially in New York, you can't. It's such a melting pot, right?
Exactly, yeah.
You know, so it's like, but at the same time, it sort of sounded kind of classic to me, and you know, I've dated a few girls, and it's always like, you can't fall for them because they're too awesome. Like, it's not like bad. Like,
yeah.
It's a warning.
It's the weirdest form.
Yeah, it's like, don't put yourself that close to getting your heart broken that bad, because that's what they will do. Because the best kind of people live in New York City, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, don't fall for New York anybody, because everybody's usually, you know, they're just living this wild dream here.
Do you know what's so funny? I've been dating my girlfriend since June, and I remember telling her, like, within the first couple weeks of us meeting and dating, I told her that it was the first time in my life being with a woman and being almost, like, scared, in the sense that, like, she so much had her shit together and she was so much of an awesome person that being around someone like that could only make you look inward, and I was like, shit.
Totally. That's it, man. Yeah, it's just almost just too much to handle, but at the same time, it's the best. It's what makes the relationship so, like, have so much color and, like, so vibrant and also so dangerous.
Exactly.
You know, right?
Did you end up living here in New York by plan or by accident?
Kind of by accident. I had a friend who had an apartment in Williamsburg. This was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And a friend of a friend who had one, he's like, oh, my friend's looking to rent this last minute for, like, who knows how much time, but he needs to know by the end of the day, do you want to live here? And I got a call going, do you want to live? The place was super cheap, and it was just, you know, it was on the road, but just down from Bedford, so it was right in the thick of it.
So when else is that going to happen?
Yeah, exactly. So I had no tours, I had nothing, so I was like, yeah. So I went down, and it was, you know, the best decision I ever made. You know, like, I spent 8 years in New York living in all the different neighborhoods, and, you know, it was so great.
You live in Queens, too?
I didn't live in Queens, no.
Yeah,
no.
That's the one. I haven't lived in Queens or Bronx yet, but I've lived between Manhattan and Brooklyn a lot.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Right? Yeah. So it was, you know, it's one of those things, you gotta trust yourself and do it.
Yeah. I know a good portion of the album was made after your friend Jay died, and I'm truly sorry for your loss on that.
Yeah, thanks, man. Thank you. Appreciate it.
It's a deeply personal thing to ask, but I hope you'll allow me.
Oh, that's like, okay.
Well, listening to the album, I couldn't help but wonder, were some of the songs inspired from going through that?
Yeah, the Drunken Angel song is just, it's just it's a letter to Jay, you know. It was hard to not do a whole record about it, you know, but I just decided to do one song that, you know, but, Yeah, there's a few lines here and there too that are definitely directed towards him, and just being in that headspace and learning to live with it definitely had a bit of a influenced the album for sure.
Have you been realizing that after the fact, or do you feel like you were aware of it while you were making it?
I was definitely aware of it. You know, like as a songwriter, you tend to get pretty close with your own feelings. You kind of know what's going on because you're constantly writing songs and trying to put how you're feeling into words and things, and so you tend to be pretty close to your thoughts and your feelings, and which makes it really good, but it also it's pretty exhausting too.
What was interesting was that I found your album at a time in my life where I was like going through like a bit of a rough patch, and it just kind of like made me think to ask you, like, do you remember the last time you discovered an album, particularly in a rough time in your life, or like where it just felt like this is the right time for you to hear it?
Yeah, the Nationals record Boxer is one of those ones for me, man. Like, it's like it was such a huge soundtrack to my time here in New York City. And I had a really, really great chapter here. So when I hear it now, it really brings me back. It's really emotional, it's really very healing,
Yeah, that album is a fucking classic.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's only I think it came out 2006 or something?
Something like that, yeah. It was an instant classic, but
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about the fact that you mentioned that you're going to be releasing Twice Upon a Hell of a Time, which is the acoustic and ukulele and piano renditions of Once Upon a Hell of a Time.
Yeah.
Was this inspired by the acoustic tour you did a couple months back?
Yeah. We're doing a lot of acoustic sort of playing and singing these days, so I thought I was sort of in the zone, because I wrote all the songs sort of, a lot of them in that sort of setting, right on the piano or guitar, acoustic guitar, so some on the ukulele. So I kind of just thought, why not? Because, just bang them off so you can actually hear the songs a little more. They don't really get sort of interrupted by all the different production elements, which I also love, but it's kind of nice to hear them stripped down and get to the point.
I mean, you mentioned before like how you wrote these songs in a way where they must exist within that frame where they could work being stripped down like that, but does it surprise you that it works that well, these songs?
Because I write them like that, I know they're going to work, So it's sort of like they kind of started on that, in that level, sort of on an acoustic guitar. So I make sure they kind of hold up like that, because I know that I play solo gigs a lot too, so I can't just play rockers or like AC/DC style songs out on acoustic, I feel like if a song doesn't hold up on a ukulele, then it's probably not a song. You need to have a melody and words for a song, It's not just guitar riffs and drum sounds.
Well, tell me this, with this most recent acoustic run you did, what was it like bringing these songs out into that kind of atmosphere? Because I imagine for so many people, even though we're talking about it this way, so many people are familiar with them in the rock sense. So what was it like for that? How do you think it was for you?
Well, it works great, because I mean, the way I look at it is some people are going to hear the Twice Upon a Hell of a Time first, you know, and that'll be what they get used to, and then they'll hear the sort of the full band jams and be like,
that's a really good point.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So that therein lies the sort of like the song exists on its own no matter what, right? So you can turn it into a polka version if you want, but it'll probably still come across. And that's my job, is to write a song in its barest sort of form to actually hold up. So that way you can make any version of it, right? You can do a bossa nova version of it, and it's gonna hold up.
And those acoustic shows are fun for you, right?
Oh, I love them. Yeah, it's great. It's great. I feel lucky that I can do them. A lot of guys just play in loud ass bands, and then they have to stop. But it's nice to kind of go from town to town and play these songs acoustically. And I think it just gets the people that come out to the shows, they get a bit of a deeper, get deeper into the tunes themselves. Yeah. So then when we come back with the full band, they kind of know the song a little more.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe some of those lyrics you can't hear that well.
Yeah. Before I let you go, I have to know, would you say making this album was as fun as it has been listening to it? Or has touring it as well?
We had more fun making this record than any record I think I've ever made. Yeah. Lil's like one of the funniest people I know. And
he's in your band, right?
Yeah, he's playing tonight, yes. And so we just keep it light, you know. We're from the East Coast, Canada. Like, we're just hosers, you know. Let's have a good time. And you know, we took it very, very seriously, but at the same time, really laid back too. You know, we're very serious with the songs, but the way we approached it was to be just ourselves and just two buds in a jam space, pretty much, you know. And we had a fantastic time.
That's awesome. Matt, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, man.
It.
Thanks a lot.
Great time for the chunk.
Yeah. All you lovers, don't say you were never told.